Hey there, I'm David Gilbert, a senior reporter on the Wired Politics team. Before we begin today's podcast, I wanted to mention that we're putting together an episode all about disinformation. Think about it as Wired's guide to disinfo, and we need you to be a part of it. What questions do you have about disinfo? We want to hear it all. We'll be reading through the mailbox and answering your questions on the show. So please send us your questions related to disinformation to politicslab@wired.com. That's politicslab@wired.com. And one more thing, if you haven't checked out our newsletter, please sign up. There's a link in our show notes. Thanks.
Welcome to Wired Politics Lab, a show about how tech is changing politics. I'm Leah Feiger, the senior politics editor at Wired. Today on the show, we're talking about an exclusive Wired story that just dropped today. It details how far-right extremist militias are organizing online, specifically on Facebook. After laying low for several years, militia extremists have been quietly reorganizing. They've formed a couple hundred Facebook groups and profiles, both public and private, to recruit and assemble local militia activity across the country. This isn't allowed per Meta's own safety standards. But these groups are there, coordinating on Facebook ahead of the November election, encouraging combat training, and telling followers to prepare. Joining me to talk about all of this is David Gilbert, a senior reporter on Wired's politics desk. Hey, David.
Hey, Leah.
And Tess Owen, a Wired contributor and expert on extremism, disinformation, and politics, and the author of the story we're about to dig into. Tess, welcome. You've just spent weeks looking into how these groups are organizing on Facebook. What did you think when you first started looking into this?
So I was surprised, actually. You had asked me where militias were and what they were up to. And since January 6th, we really haven't seen them. They've kind of retreated from the public sphere. And so when I started trying to figure out where they were online, you know, where they were hanging out these days, I was doing the rounds and ended up speaking to an expert. And I was surprised by how brazen some of these groups and organizing efforts are in plain sight on Facebook, of all places.
Wow. Okay, we got to get into all of this. So what's happening here? They haven't been active in a while. Take us through that.
Right. So we've got to go back to 2020, which is when a kind of perfect storm of factors drew militias out into the streets. We had COVID-19 and the George Floyd protests, and we saw, you know, militias showing up to anti-COVID restriction, anti-lockdown protests. We saw them trying to kind of police George Floyd protests. We saw groups of men with guns in camo swarming government buildings. We saw them setting up checkpoints in Oregon for wildfires. So it was definitely building. And halfway through 2020, Facebook cracked down. So Facebook took action against the militia movement. So things were sort of building and building and building throughout 2020. And then on January 6th, we see militias play a major role.
And you were there.
I was. And I've got to say, I mean, what happened that day was so very inevitable based on what had been building, what we've been seeing in the previous month. I walked up and I saw people scaling the walls of the Capitol and walked around the other side thinking that I could maybe catch my breath and process what I'd seen and kind of go back. And it was swarmed on all sides. It was absolutely, absolutely insane. I saw someone smashing windows. I was on the steps and someone ran out and said someone had been shot. And I saw Ashley Babbitt being brought out and people chasing the ambulance. It was, again, utterly surreal, but not terribly surprising based on everything that we had seen in the previous months. By this point, it had become so normalized to see men in tactical gear at protests. Like, this was just kind of the aesthetic of that moment. And then after January 6th, so January 6th put a massive spotlight on the crisis of paramilitary activity in the US.
Right.
And this new scrutiny on groups like the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenter Network, who were later sort of implicated in the January 6th violence, that kind of caused the militia movement to retreat from the streets back into their woodland training camps. Some distanced themselves from the word militia altogether. Some split off from the groups like the Oath Keepers. So it went quiet.
Which I guess brings us to now, where it's not so quiet. How are these extremist militias now organizing on Facebook? What does this look like?
So I think what's important to note is that even though they retreated from the streets, even though, you know, we haven't seen really the same amount of like armed men in camouflage on the streets, their ideology, the anti-government ideology, has continued to tighten its grip on the mainstream. So bringing this up to now, what we've been seeing on Facebook is that there are a good handful of sort of influential militia world individuals who are playing a key role in sort of building networks of Facebook pages, urging others to add, quote, active patriots, openly associating themselves with known militia terms and ideologies. And they're trying to basically facilitate local organizing. And local organizing is always important to the militia movement because they need the in-person training.
And this training that happens on a local level, a lot of it revolves around firearms training, obviously just going into remote areas, typically in woods, conducting firearms training. But we also see them doing hand-to-hand training so that they're fighting against each other, which comes into use when they're in protests that turn violent against police and other groups. And in a lot of cases, not all of the people involved will have military training, but in some cases, there'll be at least one person there who will be running the training. And they are typically highly proficient at what they do. And if you look at some of the videos that have emerged of these trainings, it can look quite terrifying. Now, some of them look quite amateurish, but some of them can look quite scary given how seriously they're taking it and some of the hardware and some of the guns that they're using at the time.
One Facebook user with ties to a Pennsylvania militia posted a video advertising their combat training and trying to sort of get people involved. It shows people holding long guns, semi-automatic rifles, in tactical gear, and some of it looks pretty sophisticated, as David said.
Absolutely. Tess, even in your piece, you talk about how some of the people in these Facebook groups claim to be ex-military.
Right.
And so what kind of things are they saying? What do they seem to want?
So their goals are pretty vague. I mean, it's anti-government. You know, a lot of their posts are sort of convey a general sense of urgency about the need to prepare for a war or to stand up against myriad supposed enemies like drag queens or immigrants or pro-Palestine college students or, quote, communists, the U.S. government, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, George Soros, the, quote, globalists.
Me, you. I mean, like, this is a pretty massive list. I'm sure everyone's anti-David as well. So what militias are specifically involved here? I mean, you just mentioned the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, but this is looking a little bit different right now, right?
So the Oath Keepers is probably the best known militia because of their role in January 6th. Their leader, their founder, Stuart Rhodes, was convicted of seditious conspiracy. And Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, which are a far-right street fighting gang, these were the two groups that federal prosecutors sort of zeroed in on for their role in January 6th. You know, the militia movement in general has always operated on quite a local level. Oath Keepers was a very large network with some chapters operating more autonomously than others. But according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the number of Oath Keeper chapters went from 70 in 2020 down to just 5 in 2022.
Wow. I mean, yeah, they did get off the streets. Absolutely.
Yeah, the group fell apart. Like, there were some chapters of the Oath Keepers who really didn't like what they saw on January 6th. They're like, you know, we're all about respecting police and kind of being like backup for police, and they weren't happy with what they saw. So they wanted to distance themselves entirely. And then the Three Percenters was the other group that got a lot of scrutiny, or other sort of network of groups. And so what we're seeing on Facebook now is a lot of Three Percenters, specifically a network of groups called American Patriot 3%, which is on Facebook's own list of banned organizations, dangerous organizations. And that has been kind of one of the most prevalent militia networks that I've seen come up again and again. But again, people are trying to facilitate local organizing within that network.
I mean, that's the thing that was so shocking to me reading your stories. We're looking at like this Pennsylvania chapter, this Georgia chapter. It's state by state. It's county by county. Has that always been how these groups have operated? Or does this feel like a new chapter to you?
I mean, the militia movement has always tended to operate fairly locally.
Sure.
And it's important that they are local so that they can, you know, go about their offline activities. They need to, you know, train. Even with these smaller groups, they establish coalitions so that if they need strength and numbers for an event, they can team up. But there's always been a massive emphasis on the need to be sort of, you know, forming these groups with your maybe your brother-in-law and your neighbor and, you know, your colleague or something.
Interesting. You know, at the very beginning when we're talking about this, obviously the bar is high for reporting on extremist militias right now in this day and age, 3 years after January 6th. And some of the things they're saying are unimpeachable. They're clearly encouraging militia action. I want to read some of these posts out loud. This one post in a 650-member Facebook group called Free American Army reads, "Join your local militia or 3% Patriot group. Now more than ever, support the American militia page." It's so wild. I mean, I knew that these movements hadn't gone away. I knew that these groups hadn't gone away. But to just see this network of Facebook pages of similar posts, I mean, were there any others that really called your attention?
So there was another one that really caught my attention, also in the Free American Army Facebook group, a private group. And this was by the administrator, who is himself a part of a Confederate 3% group. Mm. And it's a picture of a guy in tactical gear with a long rifle. It says, "They aren't ready. They weren't ready for an armed Uber driver. They weren't ready for an armed 17-year-old. They weren't ready for the people fighting back. They aren't ready for those that train. They aren't ready for those that shoot. They aren't ready for those proficient at it. They aren't ready for us. They really aren't. They keep pushing, though."
Jeez.
Just a bit ominous.
Really ominous. I mean, this is, I'm very curious what the defense is here. How do you even go about saying, oh, no, militia groups aren't an issue?
And I mean, some of these groups are more incendiary than others, sure. And that is also the case with the militia movement. Some of them are literally just a bunch of guys running around in the woods and think that, they're, you know, going to help out if there's an earthquake. And there's others who are, you know, they want to overthrow the government and they have a right. real bloodlust. There is a bit of a spectrum when it comes to militias and what they want sometimes.
Right.
Tess, do you know if, like, are these Facebook groups new? Have they just been established in recent years since the January 6th? Are they kind of old ones that have been kind of reactivated?
The ones that I've been looking at have been created in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So I've been working with Katie Poole from the Tech Transparency Project, and she's been tracking hundreds of these groups created since 2021 mostly, but she says that there has been an intensification of activity and building these groups and also forming kind of connections between them in the last year or so.
Hmm.
Is there kind of leaders emerging in those networks, or is there less of that now?
I mean, the extremist landscape in general has been very leaderless since January 6th. But there are a few kind of key influencers, I think, who are working as admins for these groups.
I mean, I'm sorry, we absolutely have to talk about reality TV star Brian Mash.
Brian Mash is the admin for the Arizona group.
The Arizona State Civilian Guard. And he was the reality TV star from the show Raising Sextuplets.
It was unbelievable. I mean, I was just in awe. Here we were, you know, trying to be pregnant. It didn't work. And to be told there's six heartbeats growing inside of your wife.
And also a failed Arizona gubernatorial candidate, of course.
Naturally.
Everyone is these days.
It's socially so true.
Yes. But, you know, it does seem like these people are emerging. And Brian, I mean, sorry to read another quote, but this one really got me of just, you know, the goal of the guard that Brian is the administrator for this Facebook account says that they are advocating and organizing as the people in order to activate the unorganized militia. What is that word salad? What does that even mean?
Yeah, it's from the Second Amendment, but it's sort of like Mad Lib's Second Amendment. Garbage.
It's wild. And, you know, of course, not to poke too much fun, but you had also written in your story that in February, he had shared a link to a wiki page for the 1946 Battle of Athens when civilians led a armed revolt against their local government. You got to read this part for us. This is so good.
Oh, yeah. "Learn your history, folks," he wrote. "The Battle of Athens, Georgia, was the last successful armed rebellion in the United States since the Revolutionary War."
But as our lovely producer pointed out last night, this battle actually occurred in Tennessee, not Georgia. So there's some new leaders. Tough to say what's happening there. I'm very interested to watch this play out. But this also gets me into, how concerned should we all be with this?
I mean, look, after January 6th, you know, there was a sense among the anti-government movement that militia was like a dirty word. People try to distance themselves from the optics of paramilitary activity. And we're seeing maybe that's changing now, that people are more willing to associate with militias or flirt with the ideas of militias. And, you know, we had a township in Michigan forming its own militia in response to new gun laws. We had prominent GOP influencers calling for civilians to form militia cells, you know, to assist sheriffs. We had the, quote, like, God's Army Christian Nationalist convoy to the border earlier this year, and militias kind of tacked onto that. And there was the FBI foiled a militia plot to launch an attack.
So they're out there.
So they're out there. Everyone always wants to know, you know, will there be another January 6th? And, you know, all the experts I've spoken to, the consensus seems to be unlikely. But also, you know, the problem with anti-government extremism in the US didn't start or end with January 6th. And
right.
So the groups who were involved, the networks that were involved, the sentiments, the grievances, they're still around. So it's just in terms of like how they organize, how they react to whatever future events. It's definitely something that I'm paying close attention to, especially with a sort of emerging activity on Facebook.
Definitely something to keep an eye on. We're going to take a short break, and when we're back, we're going to be talking about Facebook's role in this network of militia groups and what this could mean for the November election. If you haven't checked out Tess's reporting on Wired.com, the link is in the show notes. We'll be right back.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wired Politics Lab. We're going to talk about Facebook's role in propping up this network of militia groups and what this could mean for the November election. So this network of Facebook groups exists. And while we were recording this podcast, Meta, Facebook's parent company, actually responded.
So yeah, we did get the statement back from Meta. I'm going to read it out. They said, "We are removing the groups and accounts that violate our policies. This is an adversarial space where actors constantly try to find new ways around our policies, which is why we keep investing heavily in people, technology, research, and partnerships to keep our platforms safe."
So that statement is good in theory, but like you've said before, this is whack-a-mole. To be honest, Facebook has been asking both you and David
and researchers
for years to be finding these groups for them. They should be finding them themselves and removing them.
And I think their claim at the end of that statement that they're investing more resources into this is just patently not true, because we've heard repeatedly about how they're investing less money in moderation and content and putting it into AI, which clearly doesn't work. They're not hiding this stuff. This is out there. This is easy to spot. If researchers can find it, if Tess can find it, someone at Facebook surely can find it.
Even if Tess can find it.
Sorry. Sorry, Tess.
I mean, if posts that contain nudity get flagged, why don't posts trying to organize people into a 3%er militia not get flagged, seeing as 3%er is a banned organization and labeled a dangerous organization under their own rules? These are groups and individuals who are openly identifying themselves with ideologies and groups that are banned and labeled as dangerous organizations. I mean, I've reported a lot on the Boogaloo movement, the memeified Hawaiian shirt wearing cousins of the militia movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the Boogaloo movement have found ways to return again and again to Facebook and barely kind of disguising. Sometimes they'll, you know, tweak their calling cards or the way that they identify themselves, but they don't have to do much.
Facebook cracked down on this activity after January 6th and after they were blamed for letting a lot of election denialism run rampant on the site, right?
Yeah, they cracked down in, I think it was the middle of 2020, on these groups, and they kicked them off the platform. And I think what that did was that it drove a lot of these groups to more fringe platforms. And I think it's important to recognize that other platforms are also involved in the planning and organization around January 6th. So we had Telegram was one of the main channels that a lot of these groups migrated to. We obviously saw Parler was one of the main places where people
right.
during January 6th posted all their videos, and they all got taken down. And we saw even more fringe sites, like a group that was kicked off of Reddit for being too extreme set up their own website. And after January 6th, it was revealed once again, these groups are actively organizing on this website. So it's not just Facebook involved in this, but I think as Tess has pointed out, in order for these groups to reach the biggest possible audience, Facebook is the place where all those eyes are, and that's where they want to be. And it now it seems that they're back there again.
And actually, the way that they are constructing these networks is they'll have the public-facing groups, which are perhaps a little bit more mainstream.
Hmm.
By mainstream, I still mean entrenched in kind of culture war stuff.
Sure.
And conspiracies, but not quite as like, let's take up arms against the government. And so using these kind of more public-facing groups, then they can filter people into these smaller private groups, which are more extreme, to actually sort of organize and direct militia activity.
And is that all happening on Facebook, or are they moving them to Telegram or to other platforms, encrypted messaging apps or anything like that? Or are they just creating private Facebook groups?
There's been some conversations I've seen about moving things to Telegram.
Wow.
But they need Facebook, they need the biggest pool of recruits they can to reorganize and rebuild.
It's the gateway. It's they need Facebook to go mainstream.
Right.
So let's take this to the U.S. election for a minute. How do these groups and networks relate to this, and how could they relate to the election in November?
I suppose from my point of view, I have, over the last couple of years, been reporting a lot on the election denial movement, election conspiracy groups that grew out of the 2020 election. And as we saw after January 6th, the kind of militia movement waned a bit, and we saw people less inclined to talk about militias or associate with them.
Mm-hmm.
But over the course of the last 6 months, I've noticed that these groups have become much more open about their, not necessarily official links to them, but they have been appearing at the same conferences as militia group leaders. They have been, talking about militias more. They have been discussing potential collaborations between militias and election deniers. It's very open. Again, it's quite strange how it's happening so openly, I think.
I mean, David, you were just at the conference for constitutional sheriffs where you were witnessing these conversations take place, right?
Yeah. So the constitutional sheriffs, for those who don't know, are a group of sheriffs who believe deeply in the power of the Constitution and believe that they are the ultimate authority in their county and are not subservient to federal or state law. So they basically are the last line of defense between everyone and their people.
Lovely.
So this constitutional sheriffs movement is pretty small in terms of the numbers of sheriffs who are aligned to it. We don't have an exact figure because they won't say it, but they had a conference in Las Vegas last week where a number of these sheriffs spoke about, they didn't use the word militias, but what they called posses. So these are groups of citizens who they recruit. Some of them are armed, some of them are not. And one sheriff had a posse of 150 people in a county that has 5,000 people.
So that's a lot of people.
It's a big proportion of the county who are part of his posse. Now, he kind of said that this was just to help him do his job, but come election time, because these sheriffs are also spreading, election conspiracies saying that 2020 was a stolen election, we have to do more to protect our election. So if the same thing happens again in 2024 and they see or they believe that their candidate, who is Donald Trump, loses the election, the question is, what are they going to do? What are their posses going to do? So that's one aspect to it. The other aspect is the fact that people in the kind of wider election denial movement were also at the conference. And one of them, Patrick Byrne, the former CEO of Overstock.com, was there. And he went on stage and he said that militia is no longer a dirty word or shouldn't be seen as a dirty word. Specifically said that.
That totally gets back to what you were saying to us.
And I think that part of this renewed willingness to associate with paramilitary groups is also linked to the romanticization of January 6th.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Because, for the months following, there were efforts to sort of pin it on, quote, Antifa or pin it on, agitators. We've seen the prosecution of January 6thers and the prosecution of President Donald Trump has also fueled massive anti-FBI sentiment in the mainstream. And hating the FBI is like part and parcel of what militias do.
Right.
And so they're kind of, they're speaking the same language since January 6th in that sense. And then also the idea that January 6th has become sort of a lost cause for these groups is also pretty key.
And I think the January 6th prisoners themselves are no longer referred to as, sometimes political prisoners, but hostages. How a lot of people call them. And there was January 6thers at the conference in Vegas as well. So all these groups are seeming to kind of come together and they all believe the same thing and all have the same goals. And if they're all talking to each other, the question is how that will play out come November when the election happens.
Right. I mean, even from what we've talked about today, I'm trying to wrap my head around all of this. The rise of militia recruitment, the way that this is getting mainstreamed on Facebook, the way that this is getting mainstreamed within conversations of these right-wing events. How is this relating to the GOP? How is this relating to what Trump is saying, to what the GOP is saying?
I think it is a perfect match, because what Trump has been saying for years is that you shouldn't trust the government. And that message has been kind of ramping up since he left government. He's been pushing this idea that the government and oversight that the government has is bad for people. So we've had, as a result, this anti-government sentiment rising up for the last few years, and it's kind of coming to a crescendo now. And at the bottom, we have groups like Moms for Liberty who are saying you shouldn't trust the government to educate your kids, put money into private school. We have Trump at the top saying, don't trust the government, don't trust Biden, vote for me instead, and I will, you know, give you back everything that you've lost. And then in between, we've got these militias who are now rising up and pushing anti-government sentiment. And the really terrifying thing, I think, is we just don't know where those militias are going to end up in the next few months or the next few years.
Thanks, David. Something to continue thinking about and keeping track of for sure. We're going to take a quick break, and when we're back, Tess and David are going to be sharing their favorite conspiracies of the week.
New year, same phone addiction? Break the cycle of Sundays lost to doom scrolling on Elon Musk's haunted Twitter by tuning into Crooked Media's weekly podcast, Offline with me, Jon Favreau. Offline is a different kind of Sunday show, a chance to step outside our social media-fueled news cycles and hear smarter, lighter conversations about how our chronically online existence shapes the ways we live, work, and interact with the world around us. Join us each week for intimate conversations with notable guests like Stephen Colbert, Hassan Piker, ContraPoints, and Margaret Atwood. Together, we'll figure out how to live healthier, happier lives, both on and offline. So put down your screens, grab your headphones, and listen to new episodes of Offline with Jon Favreau every Sunday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wired Politics Lab. I'm Leah Feiker, and this is Conspiracy of the Week, the part of the show that's hopefully slightly more fun than everything we just talked about. Tess, David, what stood out to you this week? What's your favorite conspiracy theory?
I bring to you a sort of oldie but a goodie.
Oh, fantastic.
That Walt Disney was cryogenically frozen so that he could eventually be brought back to life, and that his body is being stored under the Pirates of the Caribbean ship at Disneyland.
Stop, what?
And
this is so weird.
Disney made Frozen so that when people Googled Disney Frozen, a film would come up instead of the speculation that he was cryogenically frozen. And
I was
thinking, you know, what would be the problem with Walt Disney being brought back to life? He made charming films for children.
Some issues there.
Yes.
Some low-key anti-Semitism, racism, you know, the works.
Definitely. but when you consider that people think that he was a satanic pedophile.
No.
The stakes get a bit higher. And I've followed, unfortunately, grooming conspiracies for the last few years. When they started around Disney, specifically, there were concerns that a same-sex kiss in a Buzz Lightyear film was, you know, part of an agenda to brainwash children into the sort of LGBTQ agenda, da da da. Anyway, satanic panics and grooming conspiracies surrounding Walt Disney go back quite far.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot of history. I don't actually think I knew about, I got to get to the Pirates of the Caribbean.
I was going to say, I think you need to send Tess to the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, Tess, report back.
And report on this.
Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous conspiracy. Okay. David, what do you got?
So my conspiracy this week comes from a group that I've followed for quite a while, and it's an offshoot of the wider QAnon conspiracy, deeply fetishizing John F. Kennedy and his family.
Right.
So they're kind of known as the JFK QAnon cult.
And you've done a ton of reporting on them.
Yeah, I have over the years, and they've been going for quite a while now. And even though their leader died last year, they're still pushing ahead with this idea that JFK will suddenly come back to life. And some of them believe that Donald Trump is JFK in disguise. And there's a whole thing going on. So this conspiracy that popped up in the last week or so is related to John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane that he used to own and sold back in the 90s. And they finally tracked it down, and they know where it is now.
Oh, no.
they're now tracking us via flight radar online so they can see the flight path goes. So on the 25th of April, which is last week, I guess, they looked at the flight path and they decided that it looked like a bomb.
Oh my God.
So I've seen the flight path. My immediate reaction is that it looked like a 10-year-old's drawing of a penis. But I can, you know, there are some crossovers there. You can kind of think it, but they
Wired Politics Lab gets racy.
They decided that it was a bomb. And so they decided that this was a sign from JFK Jr. from beyond the grave via his plane to tell them that something big was going to happen. Now, when it's going to happen, we're not exactly sure, but it will.
Fantastic. These are really good ones, you guys. I'm declaring this week a tie. Walt Disney, Satanic Panic, 10-year-old drawings of nether regions, bombs from the JFK QAnon cult. How can I pick? It's a tie.
Very diplomatic of you.
Thanks for listening to Wired Politics Lab. If you like what you heard today, make sure to follow the show and rate it on your podcast app of choice. Tess, where can people find you?
You can find me, unfortunately still on X, at Miss Tess Owen.
Wonderful. We also have a newsletter, which Wired senior reporter McKenna Kelly writes each week. The link to the newsletter and the Wired reporting we mentioned today are in the show notes. If you'd like to get in touch with us with any questions, especially your questions about disinfo, comments, or show suggestions, please write to politicslab@wired.com. That's politicslab@wired.com. We're so excited to hear from you. Wired Politics Lab is produced by Jake Harper. Vince Fairchild engineered this episode. Amar Lal mixed this episode. Jordan Bell is our executive producer, and Chris Bannon is global head of audio at Condé Nast. And I'm your host, Leah Feiger. We'll be back in your feeds with a new episode next week. Thanks for listening.
Do you like true crime?
I lost another $650,000.
True cybercrime.
I've also exposed, you know, some nation state actors.
What the Hack is the award-winning true cybercrime podcast. Each week, we talk to victims of scams as well as experts.
We got in the Senate in 2009. We created a new subcommittee on judiciary.
Serious topics discussed without being too serious.
I'm not a lawyer, but I played one in a sketch.
Listen to What the Hack with Adam Levin wherever you get your podcasts.